Honourable Macpherson, although you may be able to enlighten me.
He submitted an apology. I was copied in on the email. Yes, sometime last week. Yeah.
So we do have that, and then we don't have, then it would appear, an apology from the Honourable Albert. I know last week he was ill. This week, or the Honourable Msimang from the IFP. Those are the two, and of course a full-time member, the Honourable Floyd Chivambu, we don't have an apology from. But we can't delay our work because people are away, so we are going to proceed. And on that note, can we have somebody to adopt the agenda, please? Propose adoption. The Honourable Williams, seconded by the Honourable Grenell. Thank you very much. Now, as we move into the iteration zone, apart from issues such as exports, we do know, and certainly the Honourable Hilders brought it to my attention on flight, that there are certain issues around steel that have come up. And as I pointed out to him, this was a huge issue 3 or 4 years ago. We had a colloquium on it, in fact 1 or 2 public hearings, etc., and we reached a position. And in going through with that, with the staff, it's quite clear, and I'm also mentioning this for your own benefit as well, Minister, and that is we need a dedicated day. We may need to hold further public hearings or whatever, but there's a need for us to engage in with this in depth with all the facts and to invite the relevant stakeholders along. So if you don't mind, Minister, we're going to address that in depth, probably looking at the program, it looks like October or so. So we'll liaise with Ms. Naidu on your availability and yourself, DDG, Mr. Strachan. We'd like, on that note, to welcome Dr. Rob Davies, the Minister of Trade and Industry. We have with us Mr. Strachan, DDG, Industrial Development Division, Ambassador Faisal Ishmael, and also Mr. Litswalo, because isn't it Mr. Okay, he's not here, but we have Ms. Drukiswa Nkapapai, is that right? How are you feeling? You know, the last time you were here, not the same person, that was Kumla. Okay, all right. Okay, so you're all here, and on that particular note, we hope, Minister, you'll be able to deal in depth with the agro-processing, business items, etc., as well as possibly metal fabrication. Will you be dealing with those too as part of your presentation? On that particular note, members, we're going to ask the Minister to go ahead. You're very welcome, and it's great to see you, actually.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Chair. We've got 2 presentations. I could just say that there's quite a lot of other things that have emerged in the meantime. I want to consider at some point the developments of the regional integration arrangements, tripartite, continental, World Trade Organization, all those kind of stuff. But we are going to present in I think, on some time, and apologies for that if it's my fault, the report on the Industrial Policy Action Plan for 2015-16 to 2018-19. The documents in question are this is the document, the actual document. And then for those that prefer diagrams and pictures to writing, there's a short version as well. So that's what we're going to present. But one of the major themes, and it is also covered in the 9-point plan of government for investing the economy, is a higher impact item. So I think that in order to make that clear what we mean by a higher impact item, I think what we felt it's important to show is some of the implementation highlights and some of the strength and policy platforms that we have developed as a basis for understanding where we move forward. I think that's because also if we look at the macro picture, of course we find that there are a number of constraints on manufacturing. Some of them from global challenges. You mentioned the iron and steel, so let me mention that what the challenge is right now is that there is a glut of steel in the world as a whole, and that that steel glut is finding its way into other markets from the markets where most of it is produced. And in fact, there are real indications that there's dumping taking place. And just to say that we are in discussions with steel makers, and there are submissions that have taken place to ITEP, but of course there are issues that are long-standing, which we also want to make sure are not affected by any decisions we may take in that regard. So what we're going to do is just show what we think, where we think we stand with industrial policy, as a way of saying what do we mean by a higher impact, and then go through what this particular iteration of IPAC is saying are the main measures that need to be taken, and then we will go through some of the challenges and conclusion. So I think that this is just to say where this is like gone. We launched it in early May. As I think we had to clarify the launch this time around, IPAC is not, the annual IPACs are not a new policy framework. It is an action plan. The main content of the long document is a set of time-bound actions which have to be undertaken by different parts of governments, different players in government, to give effect to government's contribution to industrial policy. And the priorities of this one are, as we try to understand what we mean by moving towards a higher impact, we want to strengthen conditionalities and packaging of government and DFI industrial finance. For the productive sectors, what we mean by this is we want to have a closer, it's not that it doesn't happen now, a closer alignment of decisions that are taken to deploy incentives and industrial finance coming from DFIs like the Industrial Development Corporation at project level. That's what we're going to do. Public procurement, we've seen, and I will go through some of the successes we've achieved from public procurement. We want to build on the successes in a number of policy platforms in some of the sectors, autos, clothing, textiles, footwear, metals and engineering, agro-processing, business process services in the film sector. And then we want to boost new growth sectors, oil and gas, renewable energy, aerospace and defense. And we want to unlock export opportunities, particularly on the African continent, and advance the agenda of regional integration, but also regional industrialization. These are the drivers of industrial development that we see. We see there as basically three ways in which industrialization can proceed. Infrastructure driven, that means that as we roll out infrastructure through tools like localization and other tools, we can get industries that supply inputs into the infrastructure build. Resource-based industrialization, that is really addressing the question of mineral beneficiation. How do we add value to the mineral resources we have? And you see there's quite a few things we're working on, for example, that fuel cell. And then advanced manufacturing-driven industrialization, including innovation. There are some of the levers that we're talking about, more closely packaged and linked, and with higher levels of additionality around finance, localization both in the private and public sector, access to the African markets, and supporting regional industrialization, and more regulation efficiencies. These are the things that we think we can achieve: real value addition, employment, investment, exports, economy-wide growth, and linkages. I don't think I have to make a point to this committee as to why we need to move up the value chain and why we have to industrialize, but just to say that in this iteration of IPAP, you will see something which I think is underscoring the point, that the aim of the medium-term strategic framework is that we need to achieve 5% inclusive growth by the end of this term. We're not close to that at this point in time, as everybody knows. There's a number of challenges, which is why the 9-point plan is elaborated. But if we look back over the 84 quarters from the end of last year, going back into 1993, you'll see that there was only 5% growth in 16 of those quarters. And if we then look at what it was that drove 5% growth in those 16 quarters, it was one, consumption and highly import-intensive growth sectors. As you will recall from the first iteration of IPAP, we pointed out that consumption-driven sectors like hotel, retail, trade, and so on were growing twice as fast as productive sectors. And the second thing was a mineral commodity super cycle. And I think the conclusion conclusion that we've reached, of course, and I think this is something which is the general conclusion of the African continent, is that those conditions don't exist any longer to drive economic growth. We've got to find new drivers of economic growth in the productive economy. That means moving up the value chain. That means diversifying the economy. Manufacturing may not create most of the jobs, but manufacturing does have important linkages, and we're going to show it in the auto sector, for example, to service sectors. Those service sectors are both more secure and of a higher quality because they're linked to a diversified productive economy. I think that case we've made before, but I think that we want to underscore that. We try to do this, of course, against very serious headwinds. I mentioned the latest one. In addition to that, I think what we're also facing is the effects of the end of the mineral commodity super cycle. We've seen that in some of the decisions in the mining sector, where we find that actually something like 40% of platinum mines are now not profitable, and 30-something% of the gold mines. So that is the reality of the end of the commodity super cycle. We've also got, of course, the homegrown issue of the electricity constraint, which has impacted on manufacturing as well. So let's just move into this year. We're just going to go through a few highlights. And I want to start off with the auto sector, because I think I want to make the point that the policy platforms that we have had in place have delivered and have shown us that industrial policy works. Our challenge now is to scale up, and so we can start to have impact in the macro figures. The macro figures will for production, for exports, and for employment. So if we look at the automotive sector, we've got all the major OEMs that one can think of, maybe there are some that are not in that list, but we have productive activity, manufacturing by a number of the majors, and in fact we see new entrants as well coming into the South African market in light motor vehicles. We've got auto component manufacturers. We have a widespread base of sophisticated component producers, including global first-tier manufacturers. There's 120 of those. 75% of those are multinationals. We have more than 200 second- and third-tier suppliers. Most of these are local companies. The auto sector has invested 25.7 billion rand over the last 5 years. Actually, the highest that the auto sector has invested in South Africa. A couple of highlights: BMW produced a million vehicle at the Rosslyn plant recently. Our exports of auto products exceeded 100 million for the first time in 2014. And the vehicle quality has constantly risen. And I think this is something that we don't understand enough. Here's an example: in autos, BMW Rosslyn plant received the JD Power Platinum Flunks Quality Award for producing models with the fewest defects or malfunctions across the globe. We can produce quality goods. Just to give another example in another sector, just so happened that last week I was at the Hisense factory I was at an event of Hisense. The Hisense factory is in Atlantis. They started off a few years ago with the support of our incentive program, our tariff rebate, the 12 high-tax incentives, and all kinds of other things in place. They started off employing 500 people and subsequently added 300 more people into the factory. And the manager there told me that this was the second most affected plant outside of China. So I said, where's number one? They said, the United States. So I said, and who are the others after us? And they were a number of OECD countries. We were second after them, ahead of a number of countries in Europe and other members of the OECD. And that was another example. We can produce quality manufactured products. We also moved into the medium and heavy commercial vehicle segment, the automotive
business. Sorry, but we can't get the name of that company.
Hisense TVs. Yeah. Okay. Then there's the medium and heavy commercial vehicle. They also make fridges, by the way. Medium and heavy commercial vehicle segment. The automotive incentive scheme package was extended to people, carriers, e-buses, trucks and buses. And bus bodies were designated for public procurement. I think it's important to just say that in 2010, the Soccer World Cup, FIFA World Cup, all the buses that were purchased for that, all of them were fully imported. Now, all of the buses that are procured for the VRTs in various parts of the country, all of them now have buses, a bus body manufactured in South Africa. So within a year of the launch of that medium and heavy commercial vehicle shipment, we got investments from companies like Iveco, Tata, BAW, Toyota, FAW, Hyundai. And there they are, some of them down there, Iveco, Hyundai, some of the investments that they've made. This is the other one. The picture there, you might recognize a few of the people there, but the important ones there are the Japanese ambassador, Mr. Fonseca, who is now also the manager for Europe, as well as Africa for Toyota, and then one of the members of NUMSA. But actually that what this was we launched the movement of the manufacture of the Toyota Cessna EV minibus taxis, moved from semi-lockdown to complete lockdown kits. We gave them a great start with the semi-lockdown kits. Between 2007 and 2011, all minibuses were fully imported. Now the minibuses are manufactured on complete lockdown kits. Here are some of the highlights. There will be 50,000 jobs in motor vehicle manufacture. Of course, the issue is that there are 70,000 jobs in component manufacturing. You get more jobs with lower investment from component manufacturing, but you don't get component manufacturing unless you have OES. So that's what we got there. And then 200,000 jobs, more jobs, in retail and after-sales service, but that retail after-sales service is linked very closely to see there's an estimate of what happened if you didn't have the manufacturing base. ARCAM projects the investment in 2013 will exceed the 2014 level, and ARCAM projects a record of $7.49 billion of investments in 2015. Government support, the program, the APDP, and before that the MRDP, we've taken production from 356,000 units in 2000 to over 566,000 units. The number of units has gone up. And with the support for government, exports went up from only 11,000 units in 1995 to 270,000 units in 2014. This has actually been the story of this program. Well, there's some people say, well, why do this? The auto sector has forward and backward linkages to a number of other manufacturing sub-sectors as well as into the service sectors. So let's look at what happened in Australia. Unlike South Africa, Australia liberalized its auto import tariffs and phased out its support program. Actually, its support program was one we learned from when we designed the MIDP. What have been the results? Mitsubishi, Ford, General Motors closed their plants. Australia's last remaining producer, Toyota, says it's going to close in 2017. The cost of the economy of this has led to the government to set up a commission inquiry into the incidents. This is what happened when you pull auto program. Australia's experience, we argue, is instructive. It's easy to consider South Africa's support to the industry in the abstract, but the reality is that if we did not do this, this is what would happen in our estimation. We'd lose 100,000 jobs in assembly of components and manufacturing. Given the negative impact on aggregate demand, it's likely that the demand for vehicles would plummet with only about a quarter of the retail and after sales jobs remaining. With the current account deficit would balloon, with loss of over 100 billion of auto in exports, and then all of the vehicles would be imported, so we would add to the import components of the balance of payments. And given that vehicles per capita in South Africa and Africa remain low, this would be a major economic opportunity for one. And what we're actually doing is to continue with the program. We are reviewing the APTP. We will be coming with that outcome of that to Canada in the near future, and eventually it will come here, I'm sure. But our aim is to continue on the track of growing 1 million units by 2020 and increase exports and progressively raise local content and job creation. I did see that there was a study by Justin Barnes to say that there are different parameters of the number of jobs that we can grow, depending on the level of localization. And of course, it is our quest to try to increase the localization of component manufacturers. Let's take the clothing, textiles, leather, and footwear sector. Between 2000 and 2010, the clothing sector lost 45,000 jobs. Imports in real terms grew fourfold, from 2.9 billion in 2000 to 11 billion by 2010. We had in place an incentive program based on duty credits. And those duty credits were earned on exports. Those duty credits could be sold to retailers. But the beneficiaries of those, it just was into the bottom line. It wasn't directly to support competitiveness. It could go into the manager's house in Pittenburg, not into the upgrading of the factory. And so what we did was we faced a major challenge to end the duty realizing that the Fed was in crisis, the economy felt the real prospect of losing its critical mass, technical design, and logistic capability. We faced a number of people telling us, after a minute, it's gone. It's no longer going to be possible for South Africa to be a manufacturer of clothing textiles. We didn't take that view, and we introduced the clothing and textile competitiveness program. So, what have we done? As of the 31st of March, we put 3.7 billion into support this, and the manufacturing value addition attributable to this program between 2009 and 2014 is 3.9 billion rand, exceeding the disbursements. And 68,000 jobs have been retained and 6,900 new jobs have been created. What we've actually done is the incentive program is based on value addition, but is only redeemable against defined competitiveness raising projects, and we don't provide support for just the bottom line. It is for particular investments in machinery, equipment, or some other competitiveness raising. And that's the effect that we've had in the most vulnerable sector. Now, I think what we've actually seen is we've seen particular sub-sectors of the clothing and textiles making progress. One of them is fast fashion. We've managed to develop, I think, important linkages between retail, groups like Fushini, and local manufacturers. I was actually speaking to one of the buyers of Fushini a while ago. He was telling me they were very happy. They said that some of our clothing manufacturers are as competitive as anything they get anywhere in the world, but they have a month to respond to the needs before imported product gets into this country. And some of them have been taking the space, and the cluster work that's been done has been yielding important results. Leather footwear, here's another one. 2,000 sustainable jobs and a reduction of 1.4 billion in trade deficit. These interventions have led to the revival of footwear firms that have closed, that were closed or under pressure due to imports. There are a few examples of different factories that have grown. Here's another one. Industrial textiles, linked to basically the production of text. I went to this a while ago in Centurion, and 5 years ago, they made a basic army tent of a civilian version with like two little tents linked to each other. That was what they manufactured 5 years ago. Now what they manufacture, on the left, that is a double-story tented facility in the desert in Dubai, which a South African company has won their contract for and built that. That is a major project showing the value of South African industrial textiles. On the right, that is actually a hangar for some military applications, a hangar for a helicopter. That thing lifts up with a machine in front there, the helicopter goes in inside that. They have a standard scope. We also have things like parachutes and other security industrial textiles. Now, I think the point we just want to make here is that we've got national and regional clusters that are working, bringing textile manufacturers, apparel manufacturers, retailers and laborers together. And those clusters, a number of those, I've just mentioned three of them, have actually achieved quite significant turnarounds, fast fashions, niche product supply development, and that I think that what we're doing is that we are achieving something here where we are beginning to see, I don't want to make any announcements today, but I think we're going to see some fairly significant and exciting announcements which are going to move this sector forward. Metals fabrication, capital, rail, transport equipment, vital components of modern economies. Okay, this is what we've done here. We've designated a number of products in terms of the different inputs into the infrastructure program. Valves. The designation of valves, there's foreign investments by a number of companies, there they are, listed down here, with investments of 100 million rand by one Denmark, ADK, and the Premier Valves Group has also made investments. Then we've got General Electric, which made a 700 million rand commitment to support innovation, enterprise, and skills development in South Africa, 500 million to support the creation of customer innovation center, 200 million in supply development. That was as a result of General Electric winning a contract which involves localization commitments. Grindrod, I went to this actually, RRL Grindrod. they have what they say is the most cost-effective locomotive, short-haul shunting locomotive, the most cost-effective one on the African continent, and it's been exported. And actually what's also happening is that some assembly work is happening in other countries in Africa. I think it's a good example. And there's a number of other examples. I don't want to go into them all. The value chain's competitiveness has been eroded by the electricity supply price increases, electricity supply challenges, and so on. So we are actually saying that we've allocated funds from the NTEF, to support economic competitiveness, and there will be further designations in that sector. Agro-processing is actually one of the largest subsectors in manufacturing. Industries we've supported to the tune of 1.2 billion over various since 2009 through NSET and the EIP. There's aquaculture incentive program as well. There's a number of examples of the various projects that we've supported. And then the difficulty we've got is to link up with APAP, and particularly to draw in a small number of farmers into procurement processes. Agro-processing can drive agriculture. It can drive agriculture by processing the added value to agricultural products, but also agro-processing investors come in and then they have a demand for these products. I don't think I'm going to go through the green economy. We have the most successful, by far the biggest program of renewable energy on the African continent, and along with that there's been a number of requirements and a number of support packages for manufacturing of the inputs there. Business process services, we've changed the incentive from one based on capital expenditure to one based on operational expenditure, and then we revised and improved the incentive a year or so ago. And this revised incentive scheme has led to some quite significant investments. For example, I went to the CCI call center and invested $200 million in Flanders and KwaZulu-Natal, and that's what they do. They're going to create 2,000 more jobs as a result of that investment. Access to industrial finance is a critical term. This is what we were saying. In foreign investment is one of the financing vehicles. We've attracted about $57 billion from 153 companies between 2013 and 2014 that have created 19,706 jobs. Let me just pause and just give you one example. I went to the opening of the second plant of Unilever. Unilever, the manager was here at the time of the World Economic Forum. His name is Paul Polman, the global CEO. Now, Paul Polman is a citizen of Europe, and the company is based in the UK. They don't see any real growth prospects in the European Union. They've got 33 factories that they're investing in and expanding. 33 factories. Most of those are emerging economies around the world. Four of those factories, more than proportion, are in South Africa. They are convinced that South Africa, as part of the African industrialization story, is a key player, and that they see that the work that they can do in South Africa is productive and useful for them. One of those factories, we won an award for, it was the Indonesia factory, Durban. We won an award from UNCTAD for that. The Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancer Program, we've supported 236 enterprises with a value of $1.1 billion, which have leveraged $3.7 billion in investments in support of 28,000 jobs. The 12i Tax Incentive, we've supported 17 enterprises with an allowance worth $2.7 billion, the tax for gone, of course, and that supported investments of $6.7 billion with the creation of 4,500 jobs. Enterprise Investment Program, the TRIP, the National Empowerment Fund, the IDC approved projects of the value of $7.7 billion between April and December 2014, creating 6,900 jobs and saving 4,700. These are the ones that benefited from the different approvals. That's just a matter of where they're going. Now, I think that what I'm trying to make the case for is that our policy platforms, our industrial policy is working, but the issue is we need to scale up. We need to scale up and scale up the impact of that industrial policy, because compared to where we need to be, we're not at that point at this moment. So we need, what do we think we need? We need stronger conditionalities to be attached to the incentives. Competitiveness raising, supplier development, localization. We need to get stronger conditionalities from our existing programs. We need to roll out the Black Industrialist Program, because what we've got at the moment is industrial enterprise in this country, foreign investments, local non-black owned companies, that's what we've got. And we need to widen the pool by actually getting in place not black business people in general, but black industrialists in particular, people that are actually active in the industrial space. That's what the Black Industrialist Program is about. We are still putting the final touches on that program. We'll come back at some point when that program is complete. We need to have new sector-specific incentive schemes. There are a few of the ones we're talking about, and the development of new incentives to support greenfield investments. The 12 I's limited to investments of 50 million and above. We need procurement. We've designated 16 products. Given that we've got a 3.6 trillion rand infrastructure investment build program, we actually do need to localize and ensure that we reduce import leakages. Here are some examples. Prasa, Ibella Rail Transport, we've seen localization resulting from that. The Alstom tender, Transnet giving various contracts which are based on localization. Percentages of the products have to be manufactured in this country. There is an example of a train, a locomotive that is being manufactured as a result of a localization designation. There are the buses, I mentioned those already, we need to ensure that, I think that the two challenges that are identified in localization. One is we've got to localize more things as we move into the infrastructure build program, but the second thing is that we also need to ensure that we get more enforcement of localization. Once a practice note has been issued by Treasury, it's no longer an option, and we need to have stronger enforcement. Now, if we move into the current IPAC, as I said, there are drawings and pictures for those who don't want to read, and I'm just going to show the graphs that highlight what's down here. So these are the transversal focus areas, the cross colors, if you like. Here is what we've got. What we're saying is I showed you a few pictures as we put along, but there are more pictures in the short version. But these are the graphs. What we've got here is we're saying what I said already. We need to ensure that public procurement, we localize more and we enforce better. Developmental trade policy, tariff setting, standards, more work on illegal imports, and more alignment of technical infrastructure. Let me just tell you how this thing is becoming a real, real challenge. We've been doing some work lately on compulsory standards on parroting stones. Now, I went in R10 to a place where the parroting stones have been causing fires. And in fact, the story we get is that the majority of the fires in informal settlements are caused by parroting stones, the majority. That means that in addition to the impact on the communities themselves, governments, local governments, is picking up the effects of that in emergency programs and so on, which we have to do. Now, what is the story? The story is that, to put it very simply, the compulsory specification on parroting stone says that if the stone falls over, there must be a mechanism that cuts off the flame, and so it goes out, and the parroting doesn't spill all over the place. Now, the difference between the compliant and the non-compliant stone, the price, is 30 rand. 120 rand versus 90 rand. We went and we were handing out compliant stones for people that gave us a non-compliant stone. We did that. We haven't got unlimited budgets to do that, but we were doing that. Simultaneously, our teams were inspecting the outlets of the city in the non-compliant stones. And, you know, trying to move further and further up and catch bigger and bigger crooks. One of the things that we discovered was we've been intercepting these things at the port. And when they call the paraffin stoves, we have them in a container, look at it, and we find most of them are non-compliant and we destroy them. They are no longer being declared as paraffin stoves. They are being declared as components. They're coming in, and we're told, and we're still trying to find out if it is, there is an illegal factory somewhere in Gauteng that works off hours because they think that nobody is there after hours, and they assemble these things into paraffin stoves and they sell. Now, I said to our team, next time round, I don't want to hear any confiscations, I want to hear prosecutions. We've got to go for people that do that. But that is an example of the kind of game that we read and the kind of steps that people will take in technical infrastructure. Innovation and technology. One of the challenges that we've identified is there's a lot of innovation going on, including in programs supported by the Department of Science and Technology. We want to have a closer working relationship with them in terms of basically science-based innovation. As I said, innovation-based industrialization or mass manufacturing-based innovation, industrialization, one of the three pillars that we identified. Industrial financing, I've gone through that. SEZs and regional economic clusters, I think we've already talked about that, but the SEZ board is in place. It is beginning its work. And then regional integration. This is critical. The African market is the major market that South Africa has for value-added products. But the rest of the continent is also wanting to move up the value chain. That is a source of opportunity for us, but also a source of challenge. The opportunity is that as other countries industrialize, as their economies progress in that direction, there should be a further demand. But the other side of it is that there will be products that we have used as finished products, which other countries will be manufacturing for themselves. How do we position ourselves and reposition ourselves in African regional value chains? That's the challenge for us. And I think we've got a few indications of how that might happen. This discussion we had with Nigeria about the auto industry is one of them, where they want to move into semi-knockdown kit manufacturing. We want to supply the inputs into that. That's the kind of partnership that we're seeking to build. The RRL Grindrod, I think, is another example. There's some level of assembly takes place in other countries, but also we're going to have to understand that they will be seeking access to our market as we seek access to their market for higher value-added products. These regional integration programs are of critical importance in that regard, and the AFRIC and the SADC industrialization strategy, which is the level of the strategy documents that is coming into an action plan next year, is also critical to us. Then we come into the sectoral focus areas. These are the ones where we've already been working. What are you going to do? Autos, I said APGD, the early review. And then we're looking at new segment strategies. There's work we're looking at motorcycle, electric vehicle manufacturing and localization. And then the African continent, I think I already mentioned that. Metal fabrication, local content, competitiveness, finance. Clothing and textiles, the CTCP, and value add. Plastic, pharmaceuticals, and chemicals, there's a number of points there. Forestry, timber, agro-processing, there we've got a number of work streams there, and BPS. The new focus areas, minerals and energy, beneficiation. Now, these are the ones that we have been identifying as value chains for beneficiation. Platinum group metals, PGMs. Which one, what is it, what can we actually achieve and manufacture there? Well, jewelry, but catalytic converters, auto catalytic converters, and fuel cells. We are already beginning to roll out fuel cells for off-grid power generation, but also for small railway vehicles that work underground in mines. Those are the areas that we want to move. Some of that will be driven by some of the SEZs. Some of that will be driven by some of the research that has been done by science and technology, but also I think that we really are going to have to ensure that we have a financing scheme, if you want to call it that, but that we have an adequate pricing regime for platinum into that sector. Iron and steel value chain remains of critical importance, but as I said, it's one which is now under strain. Under strain because it is a global glut of steel, and that steel is being dumped, the excess steel is being dumped, and that is creating a lot of challenges, not just in South Africa, but to the steel industries in many other countries. Polymers, those are byproducts of coal to oil. Oil and gas. that's the Saldana oil and gas, but also much more than that, the oil and gas value chain that can create new opportunities, and then the green energy and green transport sector. The next slide, advanced electronics and niche sectors. Here we go, aerospace and defense. I think there's a number of real opportunities we have here. I don't know how many people know that South Africa is the producer of one of the world's most competitive glider planes. When we had the manufacturing Dava, there was a guy called Ace Jonk who had a passion for these things, decided that the existing ones were not competitive. He sat down at the working cell. I think he shows us what it takes to be a manufacturer, drew on some of our programs, and now is the producer of glider planes, which are international best practice aircraft. There's many niches in there. It's in Gauteng somewhere, I'm not sure where exactly. Then localization, advanced materials, white goods and electrotechnical. I think the Ashens is an example, but there's also others in white goods. Broadband, ICT, ship and boat building, one of the outcomes of Operation Pakisa. We already manufacture world-beating things like catamarans and stuff like that. And now it's to move into also the boats that are going to be used in things like tugboats and stuff like that, and those kind of vessels. Challenges. We need to have a solution-based approach. The electricity issue. The electricity issue, I think the reason why that was number one in the 9-point plan was because that is the biggest constraint on our productive sectors. Not only is it a question of the generation, it's also a question of pricing and problems that we have at municipal level. I think that there's a tension here to those. I don't want to go into all of the issues in the electricity 5-point plan. Localization and designations, we've got a degree of non-compliance. That's what I already said. Port tariffs, rail support inefficiencies. We have, as a result of the Operation Pakisa, I think, seen that there is a change in the pricing regime. And that is important there. But the infrastructure program is also dealing with rail and port inefficiencies. And there are, for example, I happen to be the chair of SIP2, and we met yesterday. And there's a number of programs around the improvement of the port facilities around Durban, in addition to the building of the N3 corridor. Industrial finance, this is what we face. We've got to get better bang for our buck, but also we've got to get buck as well. I mean, that's a major challenge. And then red tape, administrative constraints. So ICAP is the sixth iteration. We think that it shows that industrial policy works. We think we made progress against some very significant headwinds, some of the domestic constraints, but also the global constraints. Our evidence shows that where the interventions are well researched, designed, and managed, have made progress. It's an important tool for managing planning and oversight, and it's critical that we have high levels of compliance and implementation across governments. We want to say we don't think there are shortcuts. We don't think that this quest to move up the value chain and develop new bases of growth is something that happens overnight. There needs to be continuous improvement, learning by doing, strengthening the capacity of government and strengthening stakeholder engagement and relations. So let me stop there, and just to say that that is an overview of ICAP, as well as the current iteration of ICAP, as well as some attempts to try to put that into context, because we think that this ICAP is a step towards a higher impact ICAP, and we intend, of course, in each succeeding iteration of ICAP to raise the impact yet again. So let me stop there. Thank you. By the way, yes, he's arrived now. The DG is here now. Yeah. I should have apologized for him later.
Probably the floods, or I know that Intu was a problem, that particular road, there were certain challenges there. But we're so pleased to see you, DG, Mr. October. Thank you. Yes, Minister, you know, when you were talking about this prior paraffin stoves and the shack issue, you know, and so on, a lot of the sale of irregular, illegal forms of stoves, I must say, I was certainly unaware until I got hold of the National Regulator for Compulsory Standards that we actually manufacture safe
Harrison studies in Bloemfontein, and they've got a lot of employment there, a place called Cherry Moss. And in my own constituency, Johannesburg in the city, a lot of people aren't aware that there are shacks there outside of Denver Hostel, over 300, 400 and about 80 odd burnt down in one extension. And one was able to source through Cherry Moss safe paraffin stoves, which when knocked over, it goes out, and I put it that way, flame. And I think that's very important, and what's more valuable to know is that to buy it on the street, you get an unsafe one at 99 rand, and a safe one at 100 rand. Now, a rand difference, you know, that really puzzles one as to why we're selling unsafe paraffin stoves. Those things, anyone doing that should be prosecuted, causes a lot of deaths in the community. Here in Cape Town as well, I believe, all over the country. But thank you very much. That was a quick overview, but I think we have grasped that, and let me allow members to comment, raise their questions, etc. Honourable Williams, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Kornhoff, in that order, let's start.
Thanks, Chairperson. I first want to welcome the report. I think it looks very encouraging and it looks good considering our economic challenges. But at the same time, while the DTI builds our manufacturing capacity, I think there is an opportunity to look at the transformation of our economy at the same time. So as we're building this manufacturing economy and creating jobs, we can also change the ownership relations in our economy. For instance, I'd like to know if IFAT was implemented 100%, what percentage of the economy would be owned and controlled by white business? And I also want to know what emphasis is being placed on transformation, because although, Minister, you did mention it and you talked about the industrialists, the black industrialists, I think that there should be more emphasis on transformation of our economy through this process, or else we're going to end up with a situation that we have at the moment, which is fundamentally that white people own and control our economy and black people work in our economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Minister, thank you for the presentation. A couple of general comments and then some specific questions. Firstly, on you made a comment about securing an adequate, or I wrote down your words, something like an adequate pricing regime for minerals in the beneficiation program. Now, I mean, any observer of the South African mining and metals industry at the moment will be able to see that the industry is, you know, very close to being on its knees. How is it possible, in your view, to expect them to, on top of their current woes, provide discounted prices to local manufacturers when they are at the moment laying off, you know, 15,000 workers across the gold sector, more in Umba, and possibly more in steel as well. So I'd like to comment on that. It does seem to me I noticed perhaps it was deliberate on your part, or perhaps it was just coincidence, but I did seem to notice a perceptible shift away from talking about discounted pricing in the documents, which I would of course welcome, because I think I agree with your comment that there is no shortcut to industrialization, and expecting industries to simply subsidize other industries is in my view just looking for a shortcut. Then on the clothing, textile, footwear and leather designation, there have been some, I mean obviously you know that I support that designation 100%, but we must make it as easy as possible for people to comply. It mustn't be such an additional burden that it's actually not worth the trouble. And there have been some reports from companies who have applied to your department for permission to import, for example, polyester, which is not used here, that they never get a response from the DTI, that they are required to go to their suppliers and ask them for their cost price to determine local content, whereas you know no supplier is ever going to tell you their cost price. You can't go to a clothing store and say, what is the cost price of the jacket? I want to know how much you paid for it. They're not going to do that. So I think we must take a look at the way we require applicants to comply and make sure that it's as easy as possible. example, and it's all about tax incentive. So, obviously this has been a program that's had significant success, but it comes to an end in 2017, and as I understand it, the extension to 2017 is in essence academic, because the amount of money committed is near to the maximum budget allocated to the program. So, if you could update us on your discussion with Treasury in obtaining and securing additional budget to extend that program. I would just say one last thing about the Black Industrialist Program with regards to the announcement made by ANSA earlier this week about a major empowerment deal. And, of course, as Mr. Williams has made the point, we must use the opportunity of growing the economy to also diversify the economy and diversify ownership patterns in the economy. But we must also make sure that there's not simply, we don't get caught up in an exercise of goal displacement. So the goal is to grow the economy. The goal is to improve competitiveness, and the goal is to make South Africa an economic powerhouse. But when we look at what the deal that ANSA announced, simply transferring ownership from an existing shrinking company on the point of nearly being on its deathbed, as a way of trying to breathe new life into operations to try and win some government support, that is really an exercise in goal displacement, because you haven't created any new industrialists. You may have created some Black industrialists, but they are simply replacing an ever-shrinking pool of existing industrialists. So what we want to do is create new industrialists. That is my biggest concern with that program, is that it's an exercise in goal displacement. So I'd appreciate your comments on that.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Colonel, followed by Honourable Kalaku.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two questions. Also, my thanks to the Minister for the presentation. Some good news, and thanks for that. The plans to kickstart the Nigerian automotive industry, holding challenges for us. They might be positive, it might be negative. I would like your views on that, and whether our department is in early stages to engage to see if there will be the necessary exemptions on tariffs and duties between the two countries, so that our local industry can produce local components. And maybe it's also time, that everybody wants local supply, and obviously there will be pressure in Nigeria to do the same, but I think we've got an advantage and maybe sort of a common union, customs union between us may just benefit South Africa in that instance. And then on broadband ability, I think we if we compare ourselves even with other countries in Africa and in Europe, we are lacking light. We're getting slower and slower, and it's not that we haven't got the technology. There is another problem, and I really would like your views on that, how the department can assist. Because if we look, and I constantly say that, if you see what smartphones, the explosion of smartphones is going to do to knowledge and trade in Africa, we need to be on top in terms of broadband.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kornhoff. Honorable Kalaku.
And your chair. Just one clarity on this Black Industrialist program, because what one picks up on the ground is some sort of confusion, especially from the part of a small, medium Black business people. There seems to be a misunderstanding of the program itself. And at the same time, you find your up-and-coming graduates from these technicals who have some of them produced products, which they have been trying to put those products in the field of business, but they have been getting stumbling blocks. Some of them have approached the department without any success. In fact, emails I've received from some of them, they have been saying there's no answer despite all the requirements which were asked them from them to forward. confusion around it is, because some of them, they think when we talk about this black industrialist program, we are talking about helping black people with capital or raising capital to buy existing companies, which are already operating. And some of them are not even sure, because if they get in there, they're not even trained or equipped, capacitated in that particular field. So what is exactly will be the difference between that and what we have been having, the triple BEE? And again, the other complaint and comment around is that this program is a good intention intended program, but it must not end up being like a program of a few elites in the country, benefiting through support from government, and it ends there. So if maybe we can get a clarity on that. And exactly when is the program being, as you have said, when we are preparing to roll the program. Secondly, on the one other major constraint which the minister has mentioned in the document, the power, the electricity. Is there something which is being done by, because this will need coordination between government departments and three spheres or tiers of government in order to address that problem? Is there something which is done by government to make sure? Oh, and also, if you look in our municipalities and the capacity which is there with all, you know, other tenant programs which are there, for this program, of also for the efforts which are done by the National Department in trying to make sure that we prop up our manufacturing, we deal with employment, we are localizing, are there programs in assisting local government? Because if you go to local government, they seem not to actually, in all the areas which we have designated, you find them flouting all those things and without even an explanation. Do we have mechanism to actually to make sure that those who violate those measures are actually penalized, those officials? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kalaka. Mr. I also have a couple of questions here. But I must say, a lot of it has been addressed, just one or two. You emphasized the point under automotives that, you know, the level of localization actually, you know, grows jobs. You can create more jobs with the localization. Now, how do you monitor this? What are the parameters, etc., when it comes to what you would call value addition or beneficiation? The other thing is on page 16 here, where you spoke about the 700 billion rand commitment from U.S. technology multinational General Electric. How is the department planning to make people aware of it, you know, prospective manufacturers, etc.? What strategies are in place in this particular regard? And you indicated yourself in incentivizing how some programs in the past had really, you know, worked against the objective, as it were, and one has had to do away with them. Now, how in incentivizing the current program of the sixth iteration in IPAP, how are you monitoring the usage of that grant, that those funds that are borrowed and incentives which are given in that particular regard? And the biofuels, which you refer to in somewhere along here, one of the government's programs is the deadline of the 1st of October here. Now, how does the programs that IPAP is referring to, how does that relate to the biofuel itself in this regard? And, you know, you spoke about the glider, which certainly I was aware of. I have a nephew who does do gliding at the Grand, and Swiss Barnet new glider. But we also have a company, a South African company, that manufactures trainer planes, trainer gliders. And I raised this issue 4 or 5 years ago with government, the Ministry of Government Minister, not yourself, in fact, is why we wouldn't look at this a little bit more seriously. It's offering a lot of jobs, it's adding great value, and it actually costs less than 40% of the cost of importing such trainer aircraft. So I don't know if you are familiar with that, you may be, but I certainly thought that perhaps the Minister of Defence might explore that, etc. But thank you very much. It was, for me, a really enlightening presentation, Minister. Thank you. Over to yourself.
Thank you very much. I think, and thanks for all questions. First of all, one's on the black industrialists and the transformation. What I should say is that this country needs, and the continent needs, industrialize. Some of that is happening through foreign investors coming in and recognizing the advantages of the African market, taking seriously the African regional integration programs that we've got in place, and seeing South Africa as having an important place in that. And some of that is happening. I wanted to just say, I think it's not, you know, sometimes you have this discussion about global value chains. And the assumption is that global value chains somehow or other automatically allow you to move into a good position. I want to say we've got a few examples of where we've done that, but it's because we need programs. The auto sector is one. If it was not the program, we would have been in global value chain, or we would have been there as importers of finished, completely built up motor vehicles if we didn't have an auto program. Another example, I think sometimes is the value chain. There was a company that came here during the budget vote. In fact, they came all the way from they called Zyten. This company was owned by a multinational. It sold to another multinational. That multinational controlled the global value chain. They came in here and they decided that South Africa was not going to be part of their business as a manufacturer. We were going to be a warehouse. That management, our team engaged, tried to persuade the buyer to take a different position, they would. The team that was there then formed their own company called Zytec. And that company is manufacturing its fire alarms and things like that. That's an example that you could end up in global value chains in a different place. So we need to work with foreign multinationals. We also need to work with existing businesses. But we cannot run, I think is the point that the colleagues are saying, we cannot industrialize if we are only going to build our industrial base on those two pillars. We've actually got to bring in many more of the majority of the people of this country into the manufacturing space. That's what it's about. Now, some of the tools of BEE, the new law on BEE, is going to help. Because this basically endeavor clause that was there before, as far as reasonably possible, apply the codes, has now been removed as far as reasonably possible, because you did it. And it's now going to be required to do it. So we are setting BEE targets that people have got to meet if they're going to benefit from our incentive program. That's what we're still involved in that exercise. And that will, among other things, because the emphasis there is not on share ownership deals. It's actually on a number of other things. It's on skills development. It's on supply chain development, that kind of stuff. So I think that those tools will help. And we think that will help to bring in black manufacturers into those positions. However, I think that we feel that on top of that, there is a need for a focused and dedicated program to actually encourage, incubate, support, train, whatever, black manufacturers. We have some black manufacturers in this country, but we don't have enough of them. And we have far too many people that are looking for some rather intermediate kind of role. And one of
the really important challenges that we've got in the Black Industrialist Program is to define what is an industrialist. The documents we've got and have put out already say a black industrialist is not the same as a black business in general. It's a subset of that. It's people that are involved in manufacturing, essentially, or some of the other productive centers are included as well. I want to give you an example of some of our challenges. I was in the airport in Kimberley the other day. Somebody came up and recognized me and says, "No, no, you want to get on the Black Industrialist Program." I said, "What do you do?" He says, "I run a private hospital." I said, "Well, it's not tricky." I think he was trying to say, "Well, actually, we procure pharmaceuticals, so it's linked to." And I said, "Don't qualify. We want the people who actually manufacture the medicine. It's not the people in that." So I think that's obviously what's going to happen. People are going to see it's money. Already we've earmarked. Minister Patel announced that the IDC of 100 and odd billion land that it will roll out over the next 3 years, 23 billion of that is earmarked to support the Black Industrial Program. 1.5 billion of our incentives will be used for that as well. What we've got to do is make sure that it actually supports industrialists. And just people who've got an idea, people that are involved in the manufacturing space, so that we actually do generate a cohort of black industrialists. That's what it's about. I mean, there are many of them actually around. I mean, there's a lady I know who runs a company that started off, they were repairing railway wagons up at Toes River. And now they've got a number of these contracts. They're manufacturing these things now. There are people involved in the space. But they're too few and far between. That's why we think we need a dedicated black industrialist program. We're not yet, we haven't finalized the document. We're still waiting for inputs. And it is around defining who's eligible, how are they getting access to the program, what is going to be in the program. It's going to be all of that that I think will be the difference between people will come gain the system and people will actually come and benefit from the system in the way in which it's intended to support the emergence of black industrialists. So I think that, you know, this glider company is an example. Mr. Jonker had a passion for glider planes. And he had some technological background working in Genel. And he then went through the exercise and he drew on our incentives, but it wasn't dependent on our incentives. Our incentives helped him to move further up and to get the thing into production. That's what it did. It helped him. It wasn't that we needed to give him everything, a packet of money and everything. And we want to find people like that. And there are people like that among black people in this country who've had difficulty accessing this or that or the other thing. But I think that we need to set out a very clear message that it's not every existing intermediary is going to come in and call themselves a black industrialist. We're going to define it in such a way that it's clear who qualifies and who doesn't qualify. Then if I come on to sort of the points raised by Honourable Hill Lewis. You know, when you're facing a situation where your product, your mineral product, is facing a loss of markets, because that's what is behind the mineral commodity synthesizer. Our exports in value terms to China went down last year. I'm not sure whether it was in volume or only value, but anyway, it went down. And it went down because our mineral commodities we're exporting less because China's demanding less. China's on a, if you look at the new strategy, the new normal, they call it, it's actually moving towards, they're moving up the value chain, they're moving towards domestic consumption, they're moving into more services. It's a less mineral intensive growth path that they are on. It's a structural factor, not just a cyclical factor. Now, I think that probably we can expect there will be a cyclical upturn of some sort, but probably not back to the mineral commodities in the cycle of 2012. I think that's probably where we need to sort of position ourselves. So if you're in a situation like that, what do you do if you're prudent? You've got a resource. You expand the uses of that resource by beneficiating it. If we are starting to become not just exporters of platinum to somebody else, but we actually start using more of our platinum to catalytic converters, we become a fuel cell manufacturer and things like that, that is a prudent use of that resource. Now, I know that in fuel cells, it's not the only catalyst that's used in fuel cell technology. There are other things that are used. And well, I think somebody once is saying to me, well, if government subsidizes the platinum, we're on the winner. Now, why should government be subsidizing the price of platinum? We need need to have a pricing regime where platinum is sold to support the industry in South Africa. How we get there is another debate. I'm not going into that debate. But there's a price for the use of it, transforming it in our own economy, which is an advantage to somebody to come to South Africa and use platinum in, for example, fuel cells. That's what I think we would do. That's all I was saying. I'm saying anything more than that. In the case of the iron and steel industry, we know we've got an issue there. What we need to ensure, and just to go on some of the discussion, is that if we take action, which we will take as an application, we will not in principle oppose it. If we take action to support local production against the influx of, you know, steel from elsewhere, we need to make sure that the effect of that is that there's a price disadvantage for the dumped steel coming into the country, not that the local steel manufacturers decide to up their price as a result of that. That's the issue that we need to find. Otherwise, what we'll be doing is we might be saving the upstream, but we'll be disadvantaging the downstream. That's what we need to do. That's the trick we need to come to with regard to that. But I think we understand the issues, and teams are engaging quite energetically with the steel manufacturers, and we're trying to find as much to defend as much of the productive capacity of the steel industry as we can. On the question of, I think we might want to look into some of the requirements for the clothing designation. But let me just say this, on fabric, there's a debate going on, and we want an industry position, more or less, that we allow rebate on fabric. This is a proposal, but then what happens to the existing textile industry? That's the question. Is there a way we can find a solution where we, if there are fabrics that we don't use in South Africa, we don't produce in South Africa, we make sure that the production of the existing fabric manufacturers is at least taken up and that they are not disadvantaged as a result. That's what we need to do. And then on the question of the it wasn't in that one thing there, but it was one of the other ones, one of the other kids. The African continent is critical. I mean, I'm not saying it's not. The African continent is absolutely fundamental. That's why we are among the leaders in terms of driving regional integration and broadening integration, rather than, you know, we were, say, 3 or 4 years ago, we were in what we considered to be fruitless debates about whether we deepened integration, instead moved into a customs union and a monetary union. In the light of Greece, I think we can see that a monetary union among the groups of countries that were in SADC was a bridge too far, let me put it that way. And that, in fact, we didn't see any advantage of deepening integration of the FTA, customs union, what would it deliver us in terms of promoting inter-regional trade. The real issue, which is about where everyone has gone, is to broaden integration across the existing regional communities. So we have large regional markets eventually to culminate in a continental market. That's the journey that we're on. Now, I mean, there are ups and downs and there's negotiations going on, but that is where we're committed to pushing that agenda further forward, because that creates a sizable basis to support diversification, transformation of economies, and to allow greater levels of inter-regional trade. If you want to produce an exporter of copper, you don't have a huge amount of trade with the next door neighbor that's a producer and exporter of cobalt. That's the reality. If we are producing the things that we can sell in each other's neighboring markets, identify regional value chains and stuff like that, and start to work around those, that's where we need to go. And that's what I was saying, that's a huge opportunity for South Africa, because we're the most industrialized country on the continent, but it also poses some challenges. That's what I was trying to say. How do we position ourselves in the value chains in a continent that is itself industrialized? That's the issue. And I was just saying that some of the things that were raised about the Nigerian example. Nigeria has decided it wants an auto industry. They used to have one, apparently. They used to have one. Where are they going? They're going into semi-knockdown kit manufacturing. We've been involved in extensive discussions. There's been, as you know, a change of government in Nigeria. There isn't yet a cabinet in place. But we are continuing to work with the Nigerians around this. This is a sensitive tool. They want to learn from our APGB, not just read what you can read on the website, but actually learn how to implement it. We've been saying, fine, we'll do that. We'll help you to develop an auto program. But the quid pro quo is we want an agreement with you that and we've got the companies involved. That means that the suppliers, both of the components, but also of the, you know, like our thing is you import the other models, are the fully built up models. Philip Bosnian's, comes from us. That's what we want. So they produce certain models, we produce certain models. So that's the idea. That's the nature of the coming. Whether we succeed or not, I don't know. But that's the journey that we're trying to move on. On the 12-hour, we are at a point where maybe it's a pleasant challenge that we had before. There was a time when people didn't understand INSEP, and we find that INSEP was undersubscribed, and we were good citizens, and we handed back money to Treasury. Those days have long past. Those days have long past. Now we've got the opposite. To say with the 12-hour, I think we are in discussions with Treasury. We obviously are. We've got TPME, Department of Performance Management, that's evaluated quite a number of our changes, and actually these are the, you know, things that can be improved all the time. The things that we can do better, and we hear that, but we do it, we try to implement it. But I think that by and large our incentive programs are not doing too badly, and that they are achieving some results, as I tried to show. And now I think we're in a position where I don't think that we're going to see is here today and gone, there's nothing tomorrow. It's not going to be like that. We obviously are engaging as these programs are unfold. And then on the, I told you what our direction, the way we see empowerment unfolding, even when it comes to a share deal. The people who are part of the share deal, not just shareholders and nothing else, we're going to see people becoming part of the management of the company, not the public relations on or the government relations on something, but actually the real place in that. And, we can't be responsible for everything that everyone in every individual by manufacturing may decide, positions themselves better and so on and so forth. We didn't exist or argue for that. It's not our initiative. On the arm, we've spoken about Nigeria. The broadband is one of the cost cutters. I don't want to try to go through the issues, but the Department of Post and Communications, Minister Quinn, there's a whole strategy around that, which typically is positive on recognising that we are not as advanced as we need to be. I think we should avoid all these comparisons with other countries. I was in one of the ones that's often touted as a major broadband, and I couldn't actually get too much on my iPad. I don't know whether that means anything, but I think we should just avoid all these ideas that we are usually worse than everybody else, but we're not really need to be in broadband. So there's a broadband rollout strategy, which is there. I don't want to start trying to go through it. I haven't got the notes anyway. And then I think I've talked about the black industries. On the energy question, the energy question was in Aurum, and now it's an ING with new appointment in Eskom, but also with the IPPs on board and the renewable program, all of those things. I don't want to go through all of this. Where do we come in as the DTI is to emphasize the importance of a regular, affordable power supply for industrial customers. That's where we come in. There was this slogan, which I'm often queried, which is called keep the lights on. Now, keep the lights on means that the malls, the shopping centers, can keep the lights on. And in the past, there were cases where industrial customers were told to stop producing so we can keep the lights on. So that's not the right thing. We actually need to have the productive sector of the economy. We also know, and I mean, this is all, issue of funding local governments through a premium on the electricity supply. This is an issue which we raised. It's a big issue. Because we've come across cases where, municipalities haven't been receiving the results, haven't been paying Eskom, and so on and so forth, and there's all kinds of supply issues, and then there's a premium price on the industrial customers, and we've had industrial customers from outlying towns come and tell us that they actually think you're putting all the operations in housing, which is the opposite of what you want to do and want to achieve. So we've been engaging on those issues. What I can say is we engage on those issues from the point of view always of what does this mean for industrial development. I mean, of course, we would like to see a quick resolution. I think there's a degree of stabilization that we've seen, which is welcome. But we still face, of course, energy challenges. I don't want to go to that debate. That's in another portfolio. And then on the question of the localization of autos, the automotive investment scheme has two tranches. The lower one is a lower level of conditionality. The higher one is the higher level of conditionality. The conditionality is around employment and around localization. That's what it's about. Now, whether we've been extracting enough, I think that's the question I was asking earlier on. We need to get more back from that. The APGP review will, to some extent, address some of those questions. But you've got a kind of a balance that comes in the design of the APGP. And that is that some of the benefits which companies get are due to the entry of components. We have to make a balance between what we give them there and what it means for localization. But I think we know very well that we get more dots in auto components, but as I said earlier on, without there being an automotive manufacturer, we don't have auto components. I mean, maybe you get a bit of spare parts or something like that, proposed sales, but actually what drives auto component manufacturing is actually the OEMs. And then on the General Electric, I mean, I think I was trying to say that there was I was told at one stage that by various people that our localization program was a problem, we shouldn't do it, so on and so forth. And then I looked at the Buy America Act. I don't know if you know what the Buy America Act says about Amtrak, which is a U.S. train company. It says that 100% of the inputs into Amtrak must not just be manufactured, but also mined in the United States. Much higher level. Our level of localization is pitched realistically, and it has led to GE deciding to manufacture a train. But that was what the picture was about. So I think that's what it's about, as well as some of the other obligations that they've accepted as part of that. The biofuels, I don't know. I mean, I should say the team here, I don't know if anybody knows what the biofuels is at right now, but it is an ongoing saga. But it remains important that you get biofuels. I know that there are some companies that are beginning to invest in biofuels. I can't give you the latest details, maybe Garth can. And then on the aircraft and aerospace, one thing about the aircraft and aerospace is that you have the Centurion Aerospace Village. And in the Centurion Aerospace Village, there are quite a number of aeronautical companies. One of them I went to, you know that we were supposed at one stage to buy the Airbus A400M. And as part of that, we were going to get an offset. And the offset was we were going to do wingtips, and we were going to make some of the cabin components for the Airbus A400M, not just for the South African order, but for more globally. When we didn't buy it, they said it's up for open tender. Aerosuit won the open tender. And we're manufacturing there. We can produce, I mean, look, you know, we're not, I think, imminently going to be competing with Embraer. But a number of aircraft, aerospace components, particular, I don't know about the train aircraft, maybe somebody knows about that, but I do think that this is an area where we do have capacity in the area of advanced manufacturing, where we do need to move further forward. And I mean, that is something that we have identified. So I don't know, with your permission, maybe the answers wants to take those, anything I haven't said, really let him come in.
Right. Thank you very much, Mr. DDG. Sachin, did you want to add anything just there?
Just two small points, Chairperson. The global head of General Electric has been here this week, and we've had a long engagement with him. And in October, and we're hoping the minister will cut the ribbon, a General Electric locomotive with 60% local content will roll off the production line. But here's the critical issue. Of the 100 companies in South Africa that are potentially suppliers to General Electric, a significant proportion of them cannot supply the components price competitively to the required global standard required by General Electric. Therefore, the question is, can we get supply side measures to support the component manufacturers to raise their competitiveness? And one of the things, for example, we are doing is working with the OEMs and the suppliers in the same way as we have in autos to establish a supplier park where manufacturers to a range of different OEMs can be supported by the DGI. With respect to the biofuels matter, my understanding, Madam Chair, is that I think the massive collapse in the oil price from $100 a barrel plus to somewhere in the region of $50 a barrel has put the spanner in the works, so to speak. The National Treasury are involved in an exercise to understand, based on the possibility that there's a slow recovery of the global oil price, whether or not a compulsory, mandatory upliftment for ethanol and biodiesel can be supported at the existing and estimated prices for petrol and diesel, and that exercise is in the hands of the National Treasury. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DG Strachan. I know that, you know, if I just want to confirm this, Minister, I think you have to leave at, is it 12?
I need to be in the office at 12:30.
Right, I'm keeping that in mind. We do have the opportunity of having another lot of questions, but what I'm going to ask is that we quickly go and take our tea for 5 minutes, just go and get the tea, etc., come back, continue with the questions, and then go into a goa. All right, so let's just have it. Stuff quarter to 11. Can we be back at 10 o'clock, at 13 to 11, please? 5 to at the latest.
They must not incline. It's just that slowdown from a 10 or 11% growth to 7% growth has caused a collapse in world prices. So it's surprising to me that you said that our export volumes, I don't know, you didn't say volumes, you said our exports dropped from China last year. I presume then that must have been in rand value and not in volume. We must still be exporting more in volume. But actually, it raised a really interesting point, and I went back and quickly looked online at what mineral prices were before the commodity super cycle, say the early 2000s, at the beginning of the super cycle. So today's commodity prices are still higher than at the beginning of the 2000s, still significantly higher, in fact. And yet the companies are in dire straits, and I think that is a reflection of the fact that other costs in the economy have raised so exponentially. And I would have liked to see that reflected in the challenges section, maybe it's in documents, in the bigger documents. But, I mean, of course, you spoke about electricity, and that is a major cost which they now have to cope with. The labor environment continues to be unstable, unnecessarily violent, and also exponentially costly year on year. And that is a huge challenge to industrialization. So together, the suite of costs that make factors face in this country has risen exponentially over time to the point where it's very difficult to make the case for cost-effective competitiveness. I know completely that there's a different case to make. It's not all about cost-effectiveness. There are many global manufacturers who make investment decisions based on cost-effectiveness. So cost-effectiveness and cost-competitiveness, I think, has to go into the challenges section. And there must be better coordination with other government departments whose decisions impact manufacturing costs so directly and deliberately. That's the first. The second thing is, there was a report yesterday, which I actually had opportunity to discuss with the chairperson, because we shared flights yesterday afternoon. But there was a report in yesterday's paper which shocked me, that all of the steel used in the construction of Medupi and Kusile is 100% imported steel from, I think the article said, Pakistan, which was unbelievable, because in your document, the key driver in that little gears thing is infrastructure-led industrialization. Now, I wonder if you can share some comments on that and how it is that those are the two biggest infrastructure projects in the country at the moment, but you can proceed, and how it is that they have come to be using entirely imported steel. Lastly, a short question on the MSEC. We continue, I think, from our program discussion last week, Chairperson, that we're having it's in discussions again in committee sometime soon, but I'll tell you that we continue to receive very, very, very many numerous complaints, notwithstanding a slight uptick in the speed with which applications are being handled, but the FCF applications are dragging on sometimes longer than 18 months, and that even when projects have been approved, payments are being very, very late. There are some businesses that have already procured and installed 30 million rand worth of machinery on the basis of a promissory note from the DCI, and if those payments are dragging out for very, very long. So I do think that requires your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. And then that was the final set of the questions. Then, Honourable Minister, please go ahead.
Okay, well, let me start off by saying that I did say that the decline in our exports to China was in value, and I said I didn't know what the story was in volume, but it was in value. I think that is reflected in the fact that the price has gone down. That's what it is. That means that there's less income coming into the mining industry here. Now, I don't know. We'll have to go back and check whether we're talking real or nominal prices or kind of things about the prices in the early 2000s. But I think that the point is that the price is lower than it was. And that I think I say from the new normal is that while it's not that China's not consuming a significant quantity of industrial minerals, we can't expect boom based on this. I will sit around and wait for it to happen. We've actually got to move up the value chain. That, I think, is a prudent conclusion to draw from that. Then on the question of labour, there is one of the points of the 9-point plan is about promoting a less conflictual labour environment. There's quite a lot of work that's been done on that. Again, it's like any of these points that have been raised, these things are cross-cutters, but we're not directly responsible. I don't want to go into all the details on that, but there's a process going on in EDLAC around that. That would have been raised, I think, in the Department of Labour, the Department of Labour. I don't know, I think I'm going to ask Ross if it was the case. I think there can be questions about what kind of steel products, whether the steel products are made in South Africa or not, and when that was happening. Certainly the whole thrust of the dislocation is in many steel products which are not used in Madupi and Kosiya are now, which would be designated. I don't know when we're talking about and that kind of stuff. So I think maybe I'd want to ask Grant about that. And then also just ask the DGs coming on the complaints about late payments, because one of the things that I do know, and this is what I was saying to you earlier on, you've got a different kind of problem now. We've got a lot of people applying for it and a limited point. And we're having to make calls and so on and so forth. And I know people keep coming in and they want to appeal the decision not to give it to them and stuff like that. That I know of. But whether people have been allocated the funds have been getting the data, I don't know. So let me just ask Guard and offer DG if they would come in on those issues. Thank you.
Thanks
for
your
time.
We have picked up the fact that given weaknesses with respect to capital investment on the part of the key steel producer, and therefore a lack of or falling competitiveness, not only problems in relation to steel pricing and supply, but also in relation to the range of steel products from rebar long products through to flat products, there has been a discontinuation of the production of certain steel products by the main steel producer, which is a cause for considerable concern. In addition to that, we have picked up the fact that the quality of certain steel products produced in South Africa is apparently not sufficient. So in the engagements producer, as well as the secondary steel producers. As the Minister has said, a set of negotiations is taking place, and government is trying to secure conditionalities in relation to the range of products that are produced, the security of supply, as well as the quality of steel that is being produced. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you, DDG. DG, October?
Yes, just with regards to the manufacturing competitiveness enhancement program, I think, as you recall, Honorable Jay, we gave a detailed report a few months back, and then we provided the undertaking that we would expedite the and clearing the backlog. As we reported, substantial progress has been made to clear the backlog, and it's almost eliminated as we speak. I think it will be prudent for us maybe to come and give a detailed report to the Portfolio Committee on exactly where we are. But relating to the earlier question about this, there's a meeting today at National Treasury where our DG for incentives is there. But it's looking at the future of the program, but not only the future of the program, but also what the Minister raised is that all our incentive schemes now, both MCF, FOAM, is basically we've got more applications than we have funds for the financial year. So we have to make decisions about A, like we did before, we have to start maybe putting a cap on giving less to more people. That's one of the decisions we have to make. And also we have to obviously target them a bit more, but also we have to push for an increase in the amount that is available for incentives. So I think when we have that engagement with the Portfolio Committee, we can probably give a full update. And when there are specific requests, I think, as Honorable Yegos knows, we can then deal with those particular companies where there is a particular delay and so on. As you know, the introduction of the requirement that people must be level 4 has obviously resulted in a number of companies now being rejected because they are not at level 4. We ask that they, as I said, they've got good reasons to explain that there's a peer procedure in process now where we will deal with that. And that the bulk of the issue are now around companies that were turned down with regards to not meeting level 4. But as I said, we could probably have a full briefing on the entire program and the progress on dealing with the backlog.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to, at this moment, stop this. Yes, very briefly.
Very briefly, Madam Chair. I beg your pardon. In response to the Honourable Hill Lewis's question with respect to the import of fabrics, which would be required by apparel manufacturers, I met with IATEC, in fact, last week. We are not aware of a single instance where a clothing manufacturer has applied to import textiles not available in South Africa that hasn't been granted a rebate to do that. And so if there are companies that claim that, I'm sure the Minister and the Director General would allow me to say, please put us in touch with them and we will deal with it because we don't know of a single instance.
Thank you very much. Minister, we're going to leave it there with the Industrial Policy Action Plan, the sixth iteration, and move on. As I indicated earlier, I will be taking my leave of the committee and rejoining next week on Tuesday. But before I do that, I want to welcome the DDG from GAF, Elaine Alexander, who's here with us as well. I also want to thank members of other committees who've come in here to ensure that we do have a quorum, because as you know, the N2 very big accidents, as well as we have 3 people in hospital from our committee. So certainly want to welcome the Honourable Mabasa from Small Business, also the Chairperson, Honourable Bengu, Honourable Matlangu, and also Honourable Ibrahim, and also Honourable Kakane. I hope I have thanked everyone who's come in to join us to ensure we have a quorum. And
on that particular note, just before you move to Goa, and noting we will be finishing before 12:15. I wish to take my leave of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, and I will rejoin you next week on Tuesday. Thank you very much.
Arising out of the situation that just transpired recently, the chairperson is taking leave. We are now going to nominate an acting chairperson for the coming week, starting from now. May I call for nominations from the members? Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, thank you. I'd like to nominate Honourable Kalaku to serve as chair. Thank you.
Are there any other nominations? Before I do that, may I get seconded? Seconded. Are there any other nominations? None. Honourable Kalaku, you were nominated as acting chair. May you come? Can you come and take a seat? Thank you.
that the Goa had created 800 jobs in Ford factory in the United States. And what's the story there? The story there is that the engine that is being manufactured in Schoendoe, South Africa, there was a different model that was being assembled in a factory in the United States. They were hunting around for an engine that would work, and this is the one that they brought in. They brought it in under a Goa, and that created 800 jobs in the United States. So here the Brookings Institute said actually that the Goa's created 100,000 jobs in the United States and 62,000 jobs in South Africa, and therefore we argue it's a win-win for both countries. The share of sub-Saharan African exports to the U.S. Declined from 1.63% in 2014 to 1% in 2013 to 1% in 2014. Just to show that sub-Saharan Africa's share of imports in the United States is very, very low. South Africa is the only significant adult beneficiary that exports value-added products into the United States. Other countries do, mostly in apparel, clothing, textiles, and raw materials. So Goa has supported the creation of that regional value name. The South African government and the private sector remain the center of regional integration on the continent. That's one of our key messages. And the removal of South Africa will reduce the benefits of a Goa for the rest of the sub-Saharan region. So that's our argument, that it will create a hole in a Goa if we are taken out of it. We disagree with the view that because we are more developed, and I think we must misunderstand what has drawn us into this outer cycle review. It's not just a poultry question. In fact, I think it's not really a poultry question. Fundamentally, it's this idea that we are a middle-income country or an emerging market, and therefore that we should not be part of Goa. We contest that view. We say that South Africa is a country, we're a developing country, that Goa is healthy in job creation country. Goa preferences, citrus, for example, provide thousands of rural jobs, mostly women workers, and the auto sector that we have a high value-added, high-skilled jobs that will help stabilize South Africa's nation democracy. The fourth point, if you like, South Africa has made significant and continued progress in addressing bilateral trade investment concerns. We were made aware of these, and there's quite a long list of issues, and really we have to say anybody's guess what anybody wants to raise in the outer cycle review. Obviously then the US administration is going to have to decide which of those it takes up, but there were intense discussions on the poultry question, as you know. The poultry issue is one in which, just to refresh the colleagues' memories here, we have ended up in duty in force since the 1990s. This is based on the fact that there is a surplus of brown meat in the advanced developed countries as a result of the consumption patterns in those countries. That finds its way into developing country markets. It doesn't have any real economic value in the country of origin, and therefore we didn't get dumping duty. We didn't get cooperation in it, so part of the route where you can implement without cooperation. The demand originally was that we should remove it, and we said no, but we are prepared to negotiate a quota within the anti-dumping duty. That was the outcome of the meeting that was held in June 2015. Where we met with the U.S. Industry and also with officials from the United States Trade Representative's Office of the U.S. Ambassador to South Africa. And the outcome of that was the quota of 65,000 tons would come in here with a growth factor. The growth factor will be based partly on increases in consumption and partly on the growth of the economy. And there was also a number of other follow-up steps that were agreed in Paris. Among others, they were the sanitary matters, which if there are any questions as to why we put DAF here, because they are the responsibility of DAF fundamentally. But an understanding was reached between SAMA and USAPEC, which is the United States Poultry and Egg Export Council, as well as the U.S. National Chicken Council, and that draft agreement has been prepared. The South African government is finalizing the guidelines for the allocation and administration of the quota. We said we would accept responsibility for that. And DAF is engaged with its counterparts in the US Department of Agriculture on the support for historically disadvantaged individuals in South Africa, because that's part of the import agreement. And then you've got a number of sanitary and phytosanitary matters which concern what you've been calling 3M, 3 meats. There's beef, there's pork, and then there's also poultry. This is what we've been talking about in a lot of engagements. Veterinary experts have had a number of bilateral engagements since the Paris meetings. In Paris, there were Baltimore by video conferences. And there's a significant progress has been made on the technical matters, and I think that we are entering the end game of that. On poultry, the biggest issue, the biggest concern is that there has been in the United States outbreaks of avian flu in 20 of the 54 states, is it? 20 of the 54 states of the United States. But there haven't been any outbreaks in the last 6 weeks. What we've been talking to the U.S. about is a regional agreement where we accept poultry from those parts of the country where there has been no outbreak, but then there's a number of technical questions about the measures in place to ensure that there's not a spread from the affected states to the unaffected states. If there's no further outbreaks over the next 6 weeks, the U.S. might declare itself free of avian flu. We have been making progress, and I think we're drawing in other international support to try to advance this issue. On beef, cabinet approved the lifting of the ban on beef in several countries that are affected by BSE. That includes the United States. The formal communication of that is pending. On pork, there have been a number of diseases called trichinella, porcine, reproductive respiratory syndrome, and or just people don't ask me what these are, but these are diseases of pork, pigs, and just to say that this is no theoretical, hypothetical. There was pig swill that came into the country, which has one of these diseases that cost R1 billion in terms of slaughtering of the domestic poultry. So domestic pig, are they herds or what are they? Herds. We've been making progress, and we've approved a list of pork cuts that have come into this country. We've also got our own SBS concerns on apples, pears, snow fruits, and cheese, citrus, avocados, beef, chicken breast. As I said before, they consume that, but we've also had SBS measures against us on that, and then other meat products as well. So the point you want to make as well, sir, is over for trade investment. We've established excellent bilateral communication challenges with the U.S. We say we are a relatively open economy. We have the Annual Trade Investment Forum. I was at the one earlier this year. We had a CIFA meeting in Washington. We raised matters. They raised matters on tons and tons of issues in South Africa. I think we clear quite a lot of the issues because many of the information flows are incomplete, and we're able to explain a number of these things. We have TIFA. We have ways in which U.S. parties, for example, the American Chamber and others can participate in policy issues in South Africa through public consultation processes. And we have, somebody's raised this one in the Out of Cycle Review, that we have an independent judiciary with a constitution and all of that, and safeguards on property investments of foreigners. We say that the goal is contributed towards building a mutually beneficial partnership between the U.S. and South Africa. We're a vital part of regional integration. The breakthrough at the Paris meeting and the ongoing progress shows that we are able to reach an accommodation with each other. We're a relatively open economy. We have bilateral mechanisms in place, and that we need all the eligibility criteria to remain a beneficiary of the goal for the next 10 years. I think the point that we want to make is that with the interest of parties we have achieved, what I think is a national consensus on this matter, I hope that that is also carried through in Parliament, and that we have a bipartisan approach to retaining our position in this important trade regime. I should just say also that there is an AGOA forum which takes place about 3 weeks from now in Gabon. Going along there as well. start the future of Agoa, because that is the debate, what happens after this, this 10-year period. So that's kind of where we're at, and if there are any difficult questions, I shall have to rely on Faisal to come and see me. From the evident mess I've been making of this, actually not the case to put the record straight, we've been working as a team, and I think at different levels, but this team has had to do a lot of the ongoing continuous legwork that we've had to engage in around this matter. So when we go into the review with a, we believe, a confident message, and we hope and trust that we will come out of this with a successful outcome with the support of all the relevant stakeholders in South Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. Members, that progress brief report on Agoa. If there are any questions and comments, it's open. Honorable Hillows, Honorable Williams, and Honorable Albert, in that order.
Thanks, Minister. A couple of questions on the review process. There has been a suggestion in the US media and here that there's a concern that insufficient or inadequate progress has been made on actually allowing the 65,000 ton market access that was agreed. You've outlined today what progress has been made, but nonetheless, the concern persists that that we are trying to in some way play some kind of delay tactic, and that would have been our intention all along, and that would obviously be in bad faith. So your comments or the ambassador's comments on that. Secondly, who actually is going to make our presentation next week in Washington D.C.? Is it our ambassador there, or is it you or ambassador? Thirdly, the private security industry regulation amendment act has been with the president now for a very long time, and has not yet been signed, and has not yet been sent back to Parliament. So, I mean, this is something that has been commonly raised beyond the three M's that you spoke about as one of the key concerns that Congress had. And in that regard, I know that it's obviously not a bill that falls under your purview, but because it now affects AGOA, it is something that very directly affects your purview. So what is progress on that bill? What is the Cabinet's decision on it? Why is it kind of languishing with the President for so long? And what is going to happen with in relation to this in relation to this review? And then lastly, if you could just outline the process of the review in a little bit more detail. So once the USTR makes a decision, is that decision final? Or does it then still need to be ratified by Congress or by the President? And are there further opportunities for intervention later down the track? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. First, I want to welcome the report. I think that we all acknowledge that this is a strategic partnership between South Africa and the United States. And I think it's important for this Parliament to voice its support for this process. And we need South Africa to be in this partnership for the next 10 years. And I think we all agree. So I believe that this Parliament does support the AGOA partnership, and I think we should let that be known. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Minister, just two questions. First one, whether the chicken poultry issue is still the only issue, according to your mind, that is holding back the finalization of this agreement with South Africa. There's obviously some rumors saying in the media that there's other factors also, like the policy uncertainty regarding international investment in South Africa, and even to a degree the BE measures that's been implemented in South Africa. So if you can just provide certainty as to that. Then also secondly, the report notes that 100,000 jobs have been created in South Africa, sorry, in America, United States, and 62,000 in South Africa. Why are there more jobs created in the United States of America than in South Africa? Is there any way to change that, to reverse that process, to create more jobs in South Africa via AGOA? Has that been investigated at all? And is there a possibility to attract more value at AGOA going into the future? Thank you.
If there are no further questions, over to you, Minister.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to let the Ambassador also relay, give a few more details on particular SDS issues. I think that what we are trying to convey is that there is significant progress. I don't think that we're in a reversible track. The phrase I think that Honorable Hill Lewis was looking for, which is like what I learned in the US, is called play rope-a-dope. In case you don't know what that means, that's what Muhammad Ali used to do. He was skiing like a butterfly, avoiding the punches. I know that we were accused of that, but I think that we are on an irreversible course now to implement the poultry quota. Of course, I think we do need to make it very clear, and this is our position. If there is a decision to remove us from AGOA, we're back to where we were. This is linked to our continued participation in AGOA. But as long as we're in AGOA, we're committed to this. But I think that the SPS matters are not small matters. They're quite big matters. We don't need to have avian flu in the country. We need to have an arrangement in place where we can be confident that there is no avian flu coming into this country. I think that's really what it's about. But I'll let Elaine speak a little bit more about that. I think that we are going to, as I said, my information is that the Ambassador can confirm or put me right, that we all get 5 minutes and that the presentation will be given by the Ambassador and the Foreign Economic Representative of Department Sandy Dini in Washington. Then the Private Security Bill, it's not an act, bill. What I can really say on this one is that we have, as a department, been engaging with our colleagues in the Department of Police, that's what I can say we've done. I can't report on that any further, but that bill is sitting there. It's not signed into law, nor has it come back to Parliament yet, but we have been engaging with them. They are well aware of the issues, and we have been making an input in regards to that. what follows thereafter, I think, really what happens is in these regular reviews, and I don't know if it's going to be any different, but you get a letter from actually the President saying that you are eligible or not eligible. You can be made partly eligible as well, I think. That will be the outcome. So you're eligible, and then we'll have, from now onwards, I presume, a cycle review like everybody else. So that's what I think will happen. On the remarks of the Honourable Williams, I sincerely hope and trust that I can take out of this particular hearing that we have the support of Parliament in this process, and we are bipartisan on this, because I think it is important for the national interest that we go through this. Then on the question of the Honourable Albert, the process, as I said, anybody can raise anything. Some of the matters that you raised about investment law and BE, and you can add intellectual property. These are matters that we discussed when we were there for the TIFA. And I think that matters were raised, we had discussions and so on. I think that on the BE, when we explained, as I explained earlier on, when we were talking about the Black Industries Program and the way in which we've been changing the BEE to try to support the emergence of real productive sector entrepreneurs, I think that there was quite a lot of better understanding. We've been continually engaging, not just with the U.S. administration, but also with the U.S. Chamber and the Corporate Council on Africa on all of these questions, and I think that some of the
the challenges that we face is actually to get accurate communication across about what is the basis of this. Could we get more value out of AGOA? Well, that might be one of the ongoing issues, because there was some talk before the bill went through. The U.S. Trade Representative did say that they were going to look at improving the level of ashes. There are certainly areas where we could identify, we could benefit from an improvement in AGOA. I'll give one example that I know of. We did AGOA access for canned pears, and we're actually more competitive producers of canned peaches. We've raised that before, and then I became aware that there's the great state of Georgia, which is a peach state, which will say never mind dead body because of all that. So I think we've got those kind of issues that we face. But yes, I mean, I think that we could get more value in general from this, but it does have value as it stands. I think that's the point. It does have value as it stands, and that's at the moment, I think, to ensure that we continue to be part of it for a period of 10 years, which is what the rollover is. We asked for 15, but which is what the last one was. As African countries, but we've got 10 years, I think we will be going through obviously a lot of debates and discussions at the AGOA forum in Gabon in a few weeks. So maybe President Delaney wants to just elaborate on some of those points.
Thank you very much, Chair President and Minister. Well, perhaps I could just make a few comments both about the substance and the process also going forward. I mean, the first point is that I think that, we need not pay too much attention to, polemic in media. I think we need to look at the facts. The facts are that, the U.S. and South Africa enjoy an excellent trade and investment relationship. There were 600 U.S. companies here, and just last week I met again the Vice President of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who was traveling to Scott Eisen, and got a readout from him about, what U.S. companies were thinking about in the U.S. He didn't raise many issues that, some people in the media have raised. I think that the U.S. Relationship with South Africa also has begun to deepen and expand. They're looking at how to use South Africa's regional base to expand into the continent. There are excellent communication channels. The chamber, there are regular meetings between the department and ANCAM here. GIFA provides an excellent mechanism for principals, minister, and USTR to meet on an annual basis and take up issues. And, trade concerns are normal between countries, and the more intense the relationship, the more there are, issues that require more clarity and to be taken up. And as long as there are channels of communication that allow for these matters to be addressed on both sides, I think, the relationship can progress. So in that context, let me say also that we are implementing fully the decisions and agreements we reached in Paris on the quota, 65,000 tons. The industry associations are talking to each other. They are exchanging notes on how to come to an agreement on the quota and related issues and its implementation. The department, the DTI, have been working with DAF and SARS and has drawn up a set of guidelines, is now consulting on it, and will soon publish those guidelines for public comments. On the SES issues, which are more complex, there is a great deal of work that has taken place between the vets on our side and the vets on the US side. I want to say I'm from DGI, but I want to make a comment on the quality and the competence of our own vets. They clearly are outstanding. One of them is now the president of the World Organization for Animal Health, Dr. Mori Sane. Had a lot of respect internationally. The U.S. is also a member of that organization, and we subscribe fully to the rules and regulations of that institution. So, notwithstanding some of the the discussion in the press, I think one has to have confidence in our own professionals who are managing this process. Their concern is about safety, health safety of the population and our own animal herd. And I need to put in context, you know, some of these STS issues. As between the South Africa and the United States, we have in the last few years issued about 38 animal health and plant health certificates to the United States. And the United States, on their side, has issued us with four certificates, that's all. And as Minister has also read out, you know, you will see from one of the slides, there's a long list of products, both plants and animal products, that we have also made requests to the U.S. to try and clear the, you know, the animal health and plant health issues. And, you know, they are waiting. They are under discussion. There's a lot of technical work going on, and some of them have taken many years to clear. It's partly because of the nature of the you know, the issue. It takes a long time. But given the, you know, the relationship and given the goal, we have been working much harder and in a more focused way on addressing the three meat issues, poultry, pork, and beef. On poultry, you know, the issues in the U.S. are very complex. You know, as we were there a few months ago, there were new outbreaks coming. And now there, you know, there are about 20 that were announced thus far. Fortunately, those have stopped, and it's hopefully there won't be any more outbreaks in the next few weeks. This will clear the way for poultry to be imported into South Africa. The health certificate, the progress on that is well underway, and I think the veg can clear that, and Elaine can, Dr. Daff can verify. On the beef, Minister Zabwana has now written to his counterparts in the United States announcing the abandonment of the beef ban because of BC. And on pork, we made a huge amount of progress in you know, technical process of going through the cuts that they requested from the U.S. and allowing for the imports of those cuts. There are a few more, of course, the U.S. has requested, and on those, there's also a process underway by our vets to try and find a way in which more cuts can be added in a way which would be safe for South Africa. So there's a great deal of progress that has been made on the STS issues, but clearly, you know, the nature of the beast is that these will be ongoing, but we will be continuing to make progress. On the policy issues, as Minister has indicated, of course, U.S. companies do have concerns, as a South African company, with many policy debates that are still going on in South Africa and haven't come to a conclusion. And the main issue is, do we have good systems and mechanisms of communication so that you know, the concerns can be discussed, and you know, misinformation or lack of clarity, you know, can be allayed through direct information from senior policymakers, including the minister. And this is the case. There are excellent channels of communication. The chamber here is in constant communication with the minister. Speaking for my part, as the chairman of Oran Ogoa, I have been in touch every week with senior officials from the U.S. Embassy here and Washington, clarifying issues, including on the security goal, even though it's not within our domain. We haven't heard, until last week, I haven't heard about any major issue of concern to the United States that will be a major impediment for us coming out of the outer cycle review and being able to get positive and supportive indication. On Friday, we met with all the stakeholders, including BUSA, the auto industry, citrus industry, and several other industries in South Africa, we all speaking with the same voice. They will be represented also in Washington, and they will also be making representations on their own behalf. And we have coordinated a message, and I think the country will be speaking with the voice in Washington on the 7th of August. Thank you.
thank my own kind of team and both minister colleagues. Thank you, Ambassador. I think the Ambassador summed up well from the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries perspective. We've been working very closely with DTI. I think just on the letter from our minister to his counterpart, it is in process. So I'm not quite sure if they've received it, but it is in the process. I think just one comment on the poultry, in fact, on all the SPS issues. There is an agreement, the World Trade Organization, the SPS agreement, and I just want to assure you that in everything we do is approached from a scientific approach, and everything we do is done in a way to ensure that it's not this idea of blocking, it's that we have a process that we follow, and we follow that process. And from day one on the poultry side, South Africa has followed those guidelines and has followed the guidelines laid down by the OIE, which is the body which we are members of, both the US and ourselves. And we have outlined that. So that's the stance we've taken, because that's what we would do with any other country. So we have not tried to do what we have to do. So I think I just want to support what the Ambassador has said, and then our guests will continue. I think what's also important is the SPS issues are non, you know, they're not sort of, you know, we say 28 and 4, but they're always in a process. We ask for access and we work on it. They ask us for access and we work on it, and that's what we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's not to kind of dimension of the media that there's a concern about the private security, but it's a very real concern. I mean, there was a letter that was written in the Sunday Times by the ambassador, the American ambassador, which said that this is a serious concern to the U.S. government and to the U.S. Congress. So it is a serious concern, and it's not, I don't think it's going to be good enough to simply say that we're consulting next week or on Friday, whenever it is that they're making this presentation. I think we do need to have an answer. It's more than 18 months old now that it's been sitting with presidents. What is going to happen with that bill? It's not an unreasonable question after 18 months. And I do think that even if you are not prepared to answer in this committee on Friday, South African government is going to have to answer the question. And I don't think it's going to be very satisfactory to tell the US government that we can't tell you any more detail other than that we're consulting. So I'd like to press you on that, if I may. And then to underscore, the support of the parliament of this parliament is absolutely should be taken as a given, and I think of all parties in this parliament, certainly the one that I represent, AGOA is absolutely in South Africa's national interest. And while we may have some very pointed criticisms about the way that the process of the renewal and negotiations around the poultry were managed, the idea that AGOA is in our national interest and should be supported by all is absolutely a given.
Thank you, Honorable. Do you, Mr. Lawan, to respond?
Yeah. I think we can raise the temperature issues if we like, because we want to play games, in which case then I take the protestations that you are part of consensus, I take it with a pinch of salt, because I think that I told you I am not in a position to be able to say what is happening. That is the call of my colleague. We will convey into the process into the US what we can convey about that. But that what I can say is that we are in discussions, as I said already, about the implications of this and about some possible ideas of a way forward on this. That's where we're at. But it's not my call to provide any details at this point or even there, but we will be able to convey it more as government as a whole in the process on Wednesday. I think that's on Friday. But just to make the point, I think that the United States has its own security-based reviews on foreign ownership of foreign security companies in the United States. Its own security-based assessments of that. That's what they do. It may not be written the same way as ours, but they do also have security-based controls about who can enter the United States security industry. So that's the motivation behind this bill. And as I said, I think we can have a discussion about it led by, not by myself, but by my colleague in the Ministry of Police. I did say we are in contact with them. Thanks.
Minister, I don't think I raised the temperature of the issue. I'm asking, I think, there's a valid question. I accept your answer. If you're not prepared to go into any further detail than that, I'm not sure that it will be an acceptable answer in Washington, but that's the DCI's issue to deal with. But please, I say that I'm raising the temperature of the issue when I'm asking a valid question. It's been 18 months since this bill was sent to the President's desk. And we've heard absolutely nothing except these vague references to negotiations or ongoing. And I think that's a valid question for any South African to ask. Why is it taking so long? How can discussions take 18 months? You can take our support with a pinch of salt if you want to, but it is very sincere. And just because we raise concerns doesn't mean we don't support the whole package as a whole. It's not an all or nothing deal. We're allowed to support the package and still have concerns. So I don't think your objection is valid.
Thank you.
Well, I can't be drawn. I can't be drawn on that. It's another colleague that's leading the process, and the colleague will have to explain the process, as we'll have to get their input into any engagement on the process in the United States. That's what I'm saying to you. But I can imagine the fact that you've raised it and the way you've raised it, it will raise the idea of this is a significant issue, and it will be raised again in the discussion in the United States. All I want to say is well done. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. I think colleagues have expressed to all of us who are in support of this process and would be happy to see its conclusion. But I want to agree with the Minister that the issue of the private security bill does not belong here. The police portfolio committee, I'm sure, is dealing with the matter. And of course, I'm sure the department, if it's an issue which is raised in relation to our processes, it's an issue, I'm sure the department will be able to deal with at that moment. So we have come now to the conclusion of our portfolio committee meeting. Thank you for the presentation, Minister, and your team. And I'm sure we'll always be, as a committee, we might find a way to be part of some of your processes, like public hearings, you were told, so even if it's just one member, so that we get informed. We don't wait for committee meetings in that regard. Thank you very much, Mr. Our next meeting will be tomorrow briefing on the fourth quarterly report by ECIC, financial and non-financial performance, and the briefing on the fourth quarterly report by NIMSA, financial and non-financial performance. That's tomorrow. Thank you very much, members. The meeting is adjourned.